Revelation 13, verse 1, "And I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads with 10 diadems on its horns and blasphemous names on its heads. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's, and its mouth was like a lion's mouth. And to it the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority. One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast." Verse 4. "And they worshipped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, 'Who is like the beast, and who can fight against it?'" Verse 5. "And the beast was given a mouth uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. It opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Also, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. And authority was given it over every tribe and people and language and nation. And all who dwell on earth will worship it, every one whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who is slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to be taken captive, to captivity he goes. If anyone is to be slain with the sword must he be slain. Here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints." And by the way, it's a text like that and others that leads some believers to believe that Christians, that's why they don't believe in a pre-trib tribulation. They believe Christians will go through the tribulation because that's, what Revelation said. The idea is that we need to endure, persevere, etc., etc. And so when you read a text like that, that's part of the reason they believe that Christians will go through the tribulation rather than God to remove some of it. So let's take a look at several things. You have a worksheet, and there's half a dozen things about this dictator. We know that there's going to be a search and a cry for a world leader. By the way, is this anything new? Mm-hmm. We've heard more and more about globalism, right? That's become just a big part of the vocabulary that we hear and see all the time. We know that a lot of the dialogue is for world peace. Boy, if we could just get, no wars, no fighting, someone to manage everything. The European Union, remember that started? And the idea was to, and of course that was considered by Christians as fulfilling some of this, and boy, it's launching, the Lord's going to come, tribulation has started, or it's going to start, or and now the European Union's falling apart a little bit, so it's interesting. All of these things speak and remind us of what's going to happen eventually. And so we see Satan is cast from heaven. And in the very first verse, the first sentence of this chapter belongs as the last sentence of chapter 12, if we, as we look at it. And this happens once in a while in Scripture. Remember, these divisions are kind of put in there with great care. And discussion, and sometimes we would say they probably could have done a better job, and this is one of those places where the last part of chapter 12 should have been the first part of chapter 13. So, and the reason for that is because it concludes the account of the dragon and his war against God and his people. So the dragon summons the Antichrist. While some manuscripts say, "I stood," the older, more reliable manuscripts say, "He stood." He stood. John's unfolding his vision here, the dragon. The dragon summons the Antichrist. The Antichrist is described as a beast coming up out of the sea. Is this a literal sea? Does the sea represent all people? How are we to understand that? I don't know that we can be dogmatic about that. It would make sense and be appropriate if the sea represented all the people that were living. Is it a sea beast, as some might like to think? The point, in fact, is that it's not a domesticated animal. That's probably the most important thing that to glean from it. This is not some domesticated animal that we're familiar with or that we have seen. What do you think it is then? What are the characteristics? Well, it's wild. It's some kind of a vicious monster. Savage. These are some of the things that come to mind, right? Evil, you said?
Represents the Antichrist.
Okay. Well, it is the Antichrist. Okay. What's that, Jim?
Liar.
Liar?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
and we're going to see that more and more, aren't we, as he comes to power. Have you ever described somebody as a ferocious person? They're ferocious. If you said that they are rapacious, what comes to mind?
What?
Rapacious.
Rapacious.
Where's Doty? Write that down for Doty. It's a Doty word. Rapacious. These are terms that we would apply to a particularly vicious monster. No mercy, powerful, beast is a good word for it. Now, does the beast represent a person or a kingdom, or both? Okay, so when we talk about beast here, okay, the question we need to, and we see it, okay, is this a kingdom? Is it a person? Is it both? So, do you think it is, represents a kingdom, a person, both? How do you defend that, or why? Yeah, if you read the last part of verse 1, what do you read there? Okay, it seems to have to be a kingdom, if you will. It has to be understood as representing a kingdom, but then also it has to be understood as representing a person. And why? Because he's described with personal pronouns over and over again. Paul describes him with personal pronouns. Daniel describes him as a him, as a being. And so there's no question that when we think of the Antichrist, we're thinking of a person, but John seems to be describing the kingdom as well. There are probably many examples that we could choose, but one of the things that we need to understand, when we look at world empires, if I mention certain things, terms, names, not talking about personal names, you would think of a person's name. You would think of a dictator, right? Because dictators and their empire are inseparable. Okay? So a lot of times when you look at dictators, we see that their empire are used synonymously, interchangeably. Hitler, of course, is... If I said Third Reich, what would you say? You know, it's inseparable. It's just autonomic, isn't it? And so we would say the same thing here as John describes this beast that comes out of the sea, this Antichrist, the Antichrist. There's a whole lot of talk about what is the sea. Some would go to Isaiah 17 and Isaiah 57 and go up to Revelation 17 and says that the sea is Gentile nations. The problem tells us, though, when you look at Revelation, and we ought to do that, go back to 11:7, Revelation 11, verse 7. And when they have finished their testimony, the beast that rises from the bottomless pit will make war on them and conquer them and kill them. Where does he come from? The bottomless pit. Or the abyss, your Bible may say the abyss. Okay. Turn over to chapter 17. And notice verse 8. The beast that you saw was and is about to rise from where? The bottomless pit and go to destruction. And so it can't be the Gentile nations. The beast comes up out of the bottomless pit, out of the abyss. And so how would we best, what would be best to understand the sea then? I think the best way, and again, there's certainly room for some negotiation here. But what do you think the sea is? What is our best way to understand what's meant by the sea? Okay, Hades. I hear Hades. Yeah, and you're with good company, Mike. If you say the Gentile nations, you're with some really smart guys. However, I think they're wrong. But there's reasons that they believe that. So how would we understand the sea? I am in the wrong chapter. And I saw a beast rising out of the sea. And then describes what really is understood more as a kingdom. So how would we understand what's going on here? Any ideas? Is the sea being used as a metaphor to picture something, Pam?
Yes. Well, my notes say that.
We'll see if your notes are right. I'm sure they are.
The sea represents the abyss or pit, the haunt of demons. The picture is of Satan summoning a powerful demon from the abyss.
The sea of hell.
Who then activates and controls the beast and his empire.
Okay, and so C equals Satan's domain. Remember, he's not in hell.
No, he's not.
We want to make sure we understand. Hell was created for Satan, but he isn't in hell yet. And the demons who will be released in the tribulation time, remember, all... the world has not seen a full release of all the demons. There are some that are being held back until, and we've read about those, but they're not being held in hell, I don't think. You know, but hell is created for them after the judgment. So is it best to understand then that the sea as the abyss? Okay.
Because, you know, today the Jews are not religious. Like Tel Aviv, you know, it's a city in the world is the most lovable city for gays, homosexuals. Yeah. Tel Aviv.
And a few others. Let's take a little scripture journey and answer this question. See what you think. See, I think, would definitely be used metaphorically here. This is not a literal, not the Atlantic Sea or the Indian Ocean or the the Sea of Galilee or whatever. So it seems very obvious to be used metaphorically here. But to what is it representing? Is it any of these things that we've talked about? Is it all of them, part of them? And so let's begin and just have you read a couple passages. Somebody read Job 26:12 and give us a little bit of time to get there, but Job 26. Job 26, and we want to read verse 12. Take a look at Psalm 74. Psalm 74. And read verse 13 and verse 14, please. Verses 13 and 14.
You divided the sea by your might. You broke the heads of the sea monsters on the waters. You crushed the heads of pronounce that for me. You gave him as food for the creatures of the wilderness.
Did
I read the right verses? I did.
Yeah, how do you pronounce it? I'm waiting for you to pronounce that, though. We're not going to let you off the hook here.
Leviathan.
It's Levi Athan.
That's what I said, wasn't it?
Levi
Athan. What's that, Terry? I like Levi Athan. Leviathan. Okay, turn to 89, chapter 89, Psalm. Psalm 89, 9 and 10.
You rule the raging of the sea. When its waves rise, you still them. You crushed Rahab like a carcass. You scattered your enemies with your mighty arm.
And then turn to Isaiah 27. Isaiah 27. And read verse 1, please. I think Chad ought to read it. Chad, would you read verse 1 for us? Isaiah 27, 1. Verse 1. Now, in these passages that we've read, we would say that to interpret the use of sea as a metaphor is consistent with the Old Testament, yes? And so when John uses it in Revelation 13, what might he be referring to? And before you answer that, turn to Revelation 9. Go back to Revelation. But think about that. To what then is he, based on those? So we see it used metaphorically for sure. In the Old Testament is this little theme that we've looked at briefly. If you look at Revelation 9, and let me see if we want to read the whole thing. I don't. The first paragraph goes through verse 11. And you know, well, I'd like to read the whole thing, but let me just read verse 2. You know, this is the fifth angel. In verse 2, he opened the shaft of the bottomless pit, and from the shaft rose smoke like the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened with the smoke from the shaft. Then from the smoke came locusts on the earth, and they were given power like the power of scorpions of the earth. They were told not to harm the grass of the earth or any green plant or any tree, but only those people who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. And on it goes. And so we see that there are some demons that are incarcerated in the abyss. Hold your hand there in case you want to look at it again, but go to Luke. Look at Luke chapter 8. And somebody read verse 31, please. 8:31.
And they begged him not to command them to depart into the abyss.
So what's the story there? Who's talking? What's going on? You know the story.
The legion. Legion's talking to Jesus.
Yep. Okay. And so one of the things that we talked about, I think, early on in Revelation is we talked a little bit about demons and how they have to possess something. We talked the characteristics of demons that we see in Scripture, and they don't. There's something about not being, possessing something. So, you know, give me a pig, give me a whatever. And Chad, read your verse again, please.
I just flipped out.
What? Don't flip out.
Which again?
Yeah, it's okay, I got it. And they begged him not to command them to depart into the abyss. Don't send us to the abyss. Maybe it's don't send us back to the abyss. Don't send us to what we know of as the abyss. We got some cousins and some friends down there, and they're really wicked. You know, who knows? But they're familiar with it in the demonic world. And so when we look at the sea, I think the best way to understand it that John is using, and we're back, we won't go back to 9, but go back to our text in 13. The best way to understand that then, I think, is that this is the realm of satanic activity. You know, this is all this satanic activity that's going on that John refers to in the city, in the sea. So what is their ancestry? What is the Antichrist's ancestry? Where does he come from? He's going to be a man. Paul tells us that in 2 Thessalonians 2:4. At some point, we already mentioned last week that he's going to be indwelt by a very powerful demon. And this demon is going to possess him. And where does this demon come from, by the way? The abyss. He's going to be possessed. The Antichrist, this powerful man, is going to become possessed by a demon from the abyss. This demon possessed man is going to be a gifted orator. He's going to be an intellectual genius. He's going to possess great charm and charisma. The mayor from Chicago, I'm telling you. I'm telling you, he's looking pretty good there on the cover of Time, he and his spouse. Charismatic. He's going to have immense leadership power. He's going to be a good leader, a powerful leader. You know, good in the relative sense of a leader leading.
A military
mind.
Well, he's possessed, so I guess we'd say it's demonic, right? Yeah, he will be possessed. And so what happens then is you have a person with superhuman power. You have a person with superhuman power, vast intelligence, and consummate wickedness. So he's going to be powerful, smart, and wicked. Without getting distracted or go too far down the cul-de-sac, when you hear these three words to describe, what comes to mind? Anything come to mind? I'll tell you what comes to my mind, but anything come to your mind?
What three words are you talking
about? Powerful, smart, wicked. It's a horrible sea. What'd you say, Pam?
I said Satan. I thought of politicians.
Let's be kind.
You'd have to leave the smart out there.
Powerful, smart, wicked. You know, certainly Satan. How do we see historically culture changing all the time? There's always a leading indicator of where culture is going. What is that leading? Always, go back centuries, it's still the same. The details are different, the tools, if you will, are different, but it's still the same genre, it's still the same method. How do you change a culture? Education's part of it, but remember a long time ago there was an education. I mean, there was, but it was very limited. Julie?
The media and music.
Yes, there you go. Arts. The arts always, and if you read Schaefer, he brings this out well, the arts always precede cultural shifts. What happens in the arts? Oh, I can't believe that painting. You know, go back 5 centuries. Did you see what Michelangelo painted? Or remember, I don't even know when they live. I can't remember now, you know, but it's the arts. Through paintings, through plays, How did they communicate even at the beginning of our country? They would put together plays, and that's how they would communicate. How they do it in France during the Revolution. Do you have your gerbil here?
Yes.
Your gerbil cage. Hey. So, and the arts is, music is the arts. So you have today movies, music. Okay. This is all the arts. And so culture shift, and if you go back, it's a fascinating study, and if we were smarter as Christians in particular in reasoning and using our heads better, not that it necessarily wouldn't, anyway, we would understand this a little bit better, I think, earlier. The arts were always telling you ahead of time what's coming. And if you have any question where we are today, I would recommend, I'm so sorry I gave it away, I got rid of cases and cases of books, I just didn't have room, and there's one book in particular that I wish I had not put in that. It was printed, it was published in 1986 or 7. It's called After the Ball, and if you were to get a copy, I bought, when I heard about it back early 2000s, I found it online, got a used copy, I read it, and that book was interesting then. It would be mind-boggling today. Basically, it's called After the Ball, if I recall correctly. And basically, it's an instruction manual on how to shift, culture shift, to same-sex marriage, to, you know, to all of this as part of it. You know, how to introduce homosexuality. That's it. You know, remember the very rare homosexual character in a movie?
Oh, yeah.
Or even in books, unless you know, generally speaking, it was way out there. And it becomes more and more and more of the norm. And After the Ball is almost an instruction manual of using the media, you know, movies and television in particular. And people begin to accept it. It desensitizes. By the way, I'm going to go out on a limb in another way too. And I've said this before. We talked about the shack. Remember talking about the shack? And I'm sorry if this offends anybody, I'd be happy to talk with you about it. But one of the things that took me a while to realize after I listened to the shack, and I mean, Christians were coming up to me after church, "Pastor, have you read the shack? Man, it just really opened up my eyes. It's just such a good book." Matter of fact, the first person that recommended it to me, I'll never forget, he was my Bible teacher in Christian school. And he was in town doing something at the hospital. He stopped by to see if I was in town and at the office. I'll never forget. And we were just talking and visiting. And it was brand new. Hardly anybody had heard of it at the time. And he said, "It's kind of like Pilgrim's Progress." You know, he says, and he just has this smile. He says, "Yeah, you're going to, it's going to grate with you a little bit, but just read it, Steve." And "You heretic." Last time I saw him, Tucson, I told him he's a heretic. But that was, and some of you read or listened to it, and very dangerous for an unbeliever, I believe, very dangerous for a young believer, certainly. But it wasn't until I listened to the author in a 90-minute deal that he did, and then later on it dawned on me, it desensitizes Christians to the whole female thing, from ordaining female pastors to... desensitizing Christians to the gender confusion. You know, well, God, after all, could be a female. He's gender neutral. And so when you read this book, he's a female God. But what I was getting at, when you think of powerful, smart, wicked, and now with a little bit more structure, what comes to mind? Anything? I don't want to just give it to you yet. George, what comes to mind?
Democratic Party.
So we have politicians and Democrats. And I know a couple of you are Democrats, I'm sorry. You're conservative Democrats. What is in the movies today? What's in the movies all the time? What's on television?
Drugs.
Well, drugs.
Vulgarity.
And that. Well... Well, you guys are, I'm not, superheroes. Yeah, there's one. That's huge.
Uh-huh.
Do you see the comeback of superhero? They're all over the place. And, of course, you always have a real wicked villain. And they are smart. Superman, I love Superman. Lex Luthor, played by what's his name? What's the guy that played him, the goof? It was just a goofball movie. But you got to love Superman. It's okay, I don't care. Yeah, I used to like him too. But he's just such a good loony Lex Luthor. But you remember, he's a genius. He's a phenomenal, and a lot of times they are. But powerful, smart, wicked. Look at the superhero movies.
Powerful, smart, good.
And then you have the forces of good, always coming from behind. You know, the underdog. And so the Antichrist is going to be, and the other thing I was going to mention with regard to the media is, and I've mentioned it before, there's a huge interest besides just, I don't want to say just, when we say just, we minimize it, besides debauchery, open debauchery and such, we see a whole lot of the paranormal, don't we? Some of the most popular movies, and they have been, are the, you know, the demonic movies, the possessed doll or the this or that. Now they even have a, you know, they have movies with devils and with vampires and very popular things.
Lucifer's a series.
There's I don't know what Lucifer is, but
the Harry Potter series was a huge phenomenon. And I was told, and I read about the
And that split a lot of Christians, split church. I mean, I don't know if it literally split churches, but a lot of Christians were divided over that. And I remember when the first one came out. Because Christians were reading it and being entertained, we had had close friends, and their son, very intelligent, he loved them. He was a book reader anyway. And his dad and mom were close friends. And we talked about it and said, well, you know, he reads it, and it's just kind of this and that, and... But yeah, and we don't realize, okay, well, maybe this isn't real bad. Well, if I say it's real bad, you're going to drink some water with just a little bit of dirt? It's not real dirty.
Depends on if there's E. coli.
You know, but, and again, we as Christians, and I think it goes with this morning's message to some, if I'm hungering and thirsting for righteousness, I don't even need to get close to the edge. I just, you know, maybe it's pretty good. Maybe I could read it, handle it, but you know what? I just don't want to do that. I don't want to risk maybe taking my Lord to a place that he won't appreciate. You know, so this is the Antichrist, powerful, smart, wicked. Why does this come to my mind? Again, I think we see people in society and culture being conditioned and shifting. You think of the word global. Now, when we were younger, most of us, global meant what? Yeah, I'm not sure what global meant, but it didn't mean what it was today. You couldn't even think of a worldwide government. I mean, that was superhero. You know, that's what Superman was fighting. You know, those bad guys were going to take over the world. That's what Natasha and Boris and Bullwinkle, right? They're going to take over the world with these. You know, it was kind of the bad guys always wanted to do what? Take over the world. You know, global economy, global this, global that, the world's getting small. We never even heard of that. And that's part of what we see. And then just the, we wouldn't have, there's a lot of things, sinful things we wouldn't even imagine that would be acceptable to society. We wouldn't have imagined that. We wouldn't imagine what you can see on TV or in movies. We wouldn't imagine, you know, it's one thing to have like a little possessed doll and the bad guy. The bad guy was always a bad guy. Let me put it that way. The bad guy was always a bad guy. The wicked person was always wicked. There was no confusing the wicked bad guy for a wicked bad guy or gal. But see, now it's they become the good guy. They become the person next door. They become my mom or my dad or my best friend or my husband or my wife, and they have redeeming value and they're put into a different light. All this is just different ways. And we don't even realize it sometimes. And for older, mature Christians, it's probably not a deal. Just interesting, I'm not drawing any big connection here other than this person that's being described here is a person of superhuman power, great intelligence, and complete, consummate wickedness. Now, all unbelievers are children of Satan. Is that a true statement?
No.
Ooh, I knew somebody would take the bait. Jim was first. Nobody else is going to jump in that pool yet. Okay. So, are all unbelievers children of Satan? Do you want to change your answer, Jim?
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't think you would take the bait first, but okay. So why are they the children?
They will be
because they're not children.
Are they, will they or are they? There's what
they are, but they could be.
Well, Jim says they are.
Uh-oh.
Okay, you is or you ain't.
Yep.
You're a believer, you're an unbeliever. Okay.
But people change, they could get called by God.
But are all unbelievers children of Satan?
Yes.
I kind of set you up a little bit.
Well,
hardcore, there you are, adding those adjectives, trying to waffle a little bit.
So I was a child of Satan until I got saved.
Ah, so you were a child of Satan as an unbeliever. So are all unbelievers children? And Jesus said it, so that settles it. If you look at John 8, that's exactly what he says. Well, unbelievers can become believers. Mark says, right, but all unbelievers are children of Satan. Now I know why my neighbor acts that way. No, wrong attitude. Don't go there. No one in human history is going to be more completely the devil's child than the Antichrist. That was where I was going with that. You know, every unbeliever is a child of Satan. And that's what Jesus said in John 8:44. And by the way, Tanya or somebody mentioned worshiping Satan. Now, when we start getting into this, this isn't about worshiping Satan per se. You know, like Satan worship today and what happened. I think, and we may talk a little bit more about that later. The Antichrist has family likeness to Satan, and that's going to become apparent. I think John's description, he has 10 horns, 7 heads, and on his horns are 10 diadems. Now that's kind of gross, isn't it?
Yes, it's like a monster.
Yeah, that's what it reminds us of, a monster.
Monster.
Have you ever seen those 4-horn goats? They got them out at the Blue Rooster Ranch. I saw some.
No.
You know, they look, and they're called, I think their nickname is demon goats or something. Do you know what I'm talking about, Jim?
Yeah.
Just, Julie, have you seen their 4-horn goats? Yeah, well, they just said there's a whole bunch of them. If you want to go hunt, you can hunt them too. If you got a little money and go hunt them, you can mount them. But they look demonic.
They have 4 horns, yeah.
4 horns. They have a couple here. Somebody's going to Google it, I know. But they just look. But people like to hunt them. I mean, because their antlers or their horns are unique, and they like to mount. You know, you ever seen those, George? Caleb almost. He was thinking about getting one, but he got a 2-horned ram. But yeah. Yeah, they are, and your first word, your first reaction is demonic.
Yeah.
So here's that's a 4-horned creature, and our first why would we think? I should, if I was smart, I would have brought a picture of it. And you know, so now look at what's being described here. This is demonic. This is ugly. This is grotesque. And we would remember what Daniel said in Daniel 12, right? Who did Daniel describe in Daniel 12:3? He's describing the red dragon. Who's the red dragon in Daniel? The red dragon had 7 heads, 10 horns. The order's changed,
yeah.
Interestingly enough. I don't think there's any significance to it. If it is, it's certainly lost on me. But who is Daniel definitely describing there in 12? Satan. The red dragon is Satan. Who is being described here? The Antichrist. Interesting. Family likeness. Oh, Antichrist, you look just like your father. Another sign appeared in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon having 7 heads, 10 horns, and on his heads were 7 diadems. So the description of Antichrist emphasizes the importance of 10 horns.
How can 10 horns fit on 7 heads?
That is a great question. I don't know. But I know that there's 4 horns on 1 goat. And sometimes I guess I need to put that one down. And sometimes we know that there's other mutations.
Maybe they're stacked up on one or two
Then there's that. And unicorns are making a comeback, right? They're huge right now. You know? So, 10 horns. The Antichrist is described, and unlike Daniel describing Satan, who mentions a 10-horned second, the Antichrist, this is mentioned first. I don't know that there's any significance or not, but we need to note that. What do you think the 10 horns represent? And why might John have mentioned them first instead of following Daniel's pattern? Kings or kingdoms? Okay. Any ideas? Say that again. I thought you said Roman Empire, and that is exactly, this is the last Roman Empire. We talked about that last time. The last Roman Empire. So the last Roman Empire, and you know a little bit about the Roman Empire. Mike, what I wanted to ask you is when we look back at history, and we see a couple thousand years ago, both before and after the birth of Christ, the Roman Empire. If these 10 horns represent 10 nations, and that's usually where most people like to go, is that what they represent, 10 nations? So the Commonwealth, is that what it was? The Commonwealth had 10 countries in it. Remember when that happened, 80s? And the Lord was going to come. We weren't going to see 2000. I wasn't going to have to take my final exam. Yeehaw! Well, rats. Heavenly Father, please recall to my mind everything I did not study, because I really need a good grade. But quite often these are considered nations. And if you remember, some of you may remember all the eschatological prophetic nonsense that went on, you know, with 10 horns, 10, oh, this is it. The problem you have right off the bat is they would say, most of them would say, because it's pretty well accepted that the last Roman Empire is yet to come, and so we would accept that. And if you go back to the last Roman Empire so far, how many nations were part of the Roman Empire? Anybody know? Terry knows. Throw out a number. 10? That's a good guess, but no. Gong. Wrong. But thanks for guessing. Thanks for playing. It's a lot. It was a lot. And that's the point. You know, so they had a lot of nations that made up the Roman Empire. The idea is then, you know, these don't represent just 10 nations. They represent all the nations, whatever they are. There's not a good reason to think of these as 10 literal and only 10 nations. What are horns used for in Scripture in particular? They symbolize something. We talked about this, power and strength. Power and strength. They're used for attack.
Assault, yeah.
They're used for defense. So they're strong, they're powerful. We think of them as attacking, defending. A lot of Scripture passages that indicate that. But in this passage, what do they represent, you think? Well, they represent the great power of the kings who are going to rule under the Antichrist's absolute authority. So, whether it's 10 nations or not, you have the Antichrist, and then you're going to have rulers under him, right? And so on and so forth. And so this global government is going to be set up under the Antichrist. Remember, this is a superhuman being. Very smart, very powerful, very wicked. And there will be other kings or rulers or presidents or prime ministers or whatever, just throwing all the titles that we're familiar with. Are there only going to be 10? What about 7? There's 7 heads that represent 7 successive world empires, maybe? All the rulers symbolized by the ten horns are going to rule at the same time. Take a look at Revelation 17 and verse 12. And the ten horns that you saw are ten kings who have not yet received royal power, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour together with the beast. Is this what we're looking at here? If you take a look at Daniel in chapter, I'm not sure. Could be. Could be. Don't die on that hill, though. And we'll unpack that a little bit more when we get to chapter 17, I'm sure. But short kingdom, short reign. Take a look at Daniel chapter 2. Daniel chapter 2. And somebody read 41 through 44. Daniel chapter 2, 41 through 44. This is the fifth kingdom in Daniel. The first kingdom was Babylon. The second kingdom was Persia. Third kingdom was Greece. Fourth kingdom was Rome. Verse 41 introduces us to a fifth kingdom. So Daniel 2, 41 through 44, please.
And as you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it shall be a divided kingdom, but some of the firmness of iron shall be in it, just as you saw iron mixed with the soft clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly iron and partly clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly brittle. As you saw the iron mixed with soft clay, so they will mix with one another in marriage, but they will not hold together, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, nor shall the kingdom be left to another people. It shall break in pieces all these kingdoms and bring them to an end. It shall stand forever.
Go ahead and finish the sentence.
Just as you saw that a stone was cut from a mountain by no human hand, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold.
So this final world empire is going to be, in some sense, a revival of the Roman Empire. And we get that, our understanding, from the iron legs, the ten toes of the statue in Daniel. So you see here's a near application and a far application, one of those things we've talked quite a bit about, where quite often there's a dual understanding of these things. I believe God does that to kind of remind believers of what's to come. It's going to be more than just a European Confederacy. You know, we've seen that. We see it falling apart now. Because it's a worldwide rule. Ultimately, the Antichrist empire is going to be crushed by Christ. If you go back, and I've already closed Daniel 2, but if we had looked a few verses ahead in verse 34 and 35, we read that the stone was cut out without hands when he comes to establish his earthly kingdom. So the idea, the picture is that Christ just blows up the statue, blows it apart, destroys the kingdom. In addition to his ten horns, the beast is described by John as having seven heads. And we've seen this in Revelation 17. We'll unpack it a little bit more. But those seven heads represent seven successive world empires, I think. And there's Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, and then the final empire is Antichrist. So the first one is Egypt. If you look at the seven world empires,
but we don't call them global empires now. We still stick with the word world.
Yeah, they and that comes from the idea that they controlled, sometimes it's referred to as the modern world, the known world. There was always some people groups, I think, that were not under it, but they were the global power to whatever extent that meant. Who followed Egypt?
Assyria.
And who followed Assyria?
Babylon.
And who followed Babylon? Persia, or the Medo-Persian. And who followed them? And who followed the Greeks? And who follows the Romans? Antichrist. Yeah, the Antichrist, the seventh and final. And I think that that's what we see in Scripture. Like a lot of the Roman emperors and other kings and monarchs that were before these rulers, the ones that John describes for us are going to be arrogant. They're going to be blasphemous. They're going to bring titles to themselves. They're going to dishonor the true and living God. They're going to follow a pattern of their master. Who's their master? Antichrist. Paul said that Antichrist opposes, exalts himself above every so-called God or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. 2 Thessalonians 2:4. He takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. So this is who he is and where he comes from. Any thoughts or questions or comments?
When this beast rises with seven heads, does that mean that every single empire is going to be risen again on represent on each head? Because these empires have already risen and fallen. They're no longer.
Yeah, great question. I believe more, it is not. I would say no, these are not going to be risen kingdoms. I think it is right to say this is the last Roman Empire. Then the Antichrist is going to establish his empire. And that what we're reading here is a metaphoric description. And again, how would John describe this? You know, 10 horns and crowns and, you know, this, you know, and so you have a human being, and then they're possessed by Satan, and they become really smart and really powerful, very charismatic, you know, all these good things. They somehow are able to pull the whole world in, and the whole world likes him. Remember that? I mean, he's a good guy in the beginning. He's a good guy in the beginning. We talked, I think, a little bit about what happens when we go through bad. When we are attacked, what do? When we are fearful of a threat, what do? Well, we defend ourselves, but let's say after the fact. What do we do? Say that again.
Destroy them.
Well, yeah, because we're Americans and we win every war, right? Yeah. Someday we won't. All right. Things aren't looking real good. Okay. Think of dictators. How do dictators come to power?
I'll kill everybody.
They disarm
them. There is that. Okay. There's disarmament. There's taking over military. Okay. How did Hitler rise to power? Who in the world was Adolf Hitler? Before the World War. Yeah, he's a corporal. He was a little pipsqueak. How in the world does a corporal who's not particularly bright, sharp in many ways,
the hand of Satan?
Well, and that's interesting too. I was going to hold on to that hand of Satan thing. What I want to get at simply is, if you look at dictators, they tend to be popular people. And quite often, but why did Hitler rise to power? Because he promised them hope, and the economy was horrible. They didn't like the government. Things were not going well. And he was their hope. If you're not able to eat, if you're not able to feed, work, you know, if you're in disgrace from World War I already, so you're kind of suspicious, you know, the whole world kind of is looking down on you. And then here comes a guy who's saying the right things, and he's charismatic, you know, and he's able to pull people together. He creates this party, and people want safety. They want to belong. They want security. They want, you know, they want their life to mean something. They want to feed their children, right? Everybody, everywhere. And if you look at dictators, well, wherever it went, okay, they tend to be, and yes, there's some of the ugly things. You know, there's the clandestine, you know, murder and, you know, this and that. But what happens is when we go through, and I'll keep going back to 9/11, what do we do after 9/11?
Retaliate.
Well, we did that, but nationally, what were the changes at home? What were the domestic changes?
Everybody came.
Have you flown lately? There's a huge agency called the TSA that was, remember, that did not exist before 9/11.
Homeland Security.
And Homeland Security, when did that start, George? Homeland Security. And so you have this Homeland Security, and basically, what were Americans saying? I want to be saved. I'm going to give away. I'm going to give rights and freedoms up for safety and security. Happens all the time. Happens all the time. You know, and we could plug in a lot of things. Now, what did you say about Satan, Mike? And we're going to close with this.
That's how.
What did you say about Satan? Because he was satanic?
He was, it worked, yeah. I think he was Satan's attempt at forcing the Antichrist issue, and God nixed it, because it wasn't God's choice for the Antichrist.
Well, either that, or he was sympathetic with the Islamic powers, and maybe he was a
it just, yeah,
Allah.
It just wasn't in
Isn't
part
Allah
of God's
a
plan.
High-ranking demon?
Allah is my, as far as I understand, is simply another, it's an Arabic word for God. I don't know that we can make a lot of, I've heard that. I haven't seen the research or anything that would cause me to.
But all is not God.
But it makes good writing, though.
Yes,
makes
yes.
Good for,
oh, yeah.
He is not the God. Mm-hmm. He is not our God. The God. And by the way, that's, anyway, we won't go there. I just want to say one thing about Satan. Thanks, Mike. Satan has not been able to get people to cooperate with him to accomplish his purposes. I mean, it's just kind of a fun little, it's not something to belabor, but when you look at history and what have you, Satan can't even get fallen humanity to follow his plan. Or, you know, it's just, it's interesting in that it just was a tongue-in-cheek kind of a thought that I had earlier this morning, that Satan can't even get fallen man to follow his plan.
Pastor Hare.
No, he will, though.
Pastor Hare.
Yes, for a time.
Could Korea be another Hitler?
Mm-hmm. You know, our first response is what? That little pipsqueak with a bad haircut, small country. Well, he's a megalomaniac for sure. His whole family, his father, his grandfather. I mean, you got that huge statue. You're supposed to bow down to it. And I mean, he's a god. You know that, right? If he had a nuclear weapon, and it is fascinating, he keeps shooting rockets up, and we're told they keep getting more gooder and more gooder. You know, if he could put an atomic warhead on that. And remember, every atomic warhead, I know that's bad. Julie's got to go home and, on the way home. Okay, girls, I know Pastor said that, but that's bad English. That's bad English. We don't speak that way. Very poor English. Sorry. My mom used to just go nuts when somebody would use, you know, poor sentence structure or this and that, you know, being... What's that?
Double negatives.
Oh, yeah, double negatives. The whole works, you know. My grandmother was kind of the same way, being a teacher. So where were we? It's very important. We're going to finish with...
North Korea is what he was bouncing off of.
I was just going to comment. All the atomic all the atomic warheads and things, the nuclear warheads we have today, remember Nagasaki and Hiroshima and everything we have, the smallest that we have.
It's way bigger than
that. Yes.
Except for the ones that are designed to be tanked.
You know, but understand that when we talk, when nuclear proliferation and such is talked about, and we go back to Nagasaki and Hiroshima, everything every country has, everything that's out there, is way, way beyond and more powerful than those, than little man and fat boy,
yeah,
or fat man and little boy. Which one is it?
Thin man and fat boy.
What is it?
Little man and fat boy. Thin man.
No, it's little.
Is it little?
He is thin. Yeah, little man is skinny. See if I'm correct, but I'm pretty sure I am. You can go to Los Alamos and see replicas of, but there's little man and fat boy. Maybe it's thin man, but he is thin. And they, and of course, we know what happened then. About what? Nuclear bombs. Papa Frank asked about Korea. You know, could that be?
Oh.
You need to read the Enola Gay, or, you know, read Tennyson, or, yeah. And tell me if it's little man or thin man. But the point is that everything, and so that makes these little powers big threats. And then what happens typically, and I think this is important for us to understand, human beings being what human beings, we want safety. If I can have bread on my table and I could have safety, then I'm willing to give up an awful lot. It's happened over and over again. Are Americans there?
Yeah, almost. If your children are starving, it's amazing.
Oh. And this is a complete side note, and then I'm going to ask Mikey, why don't you close in prayer in just a minute. But dropping the atomic bombs on August 6th, August 9th, on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, was the most benevolent thing that could happen.
It saved millions of lives.
And you know, we see the ugliness, and it pops up on TV and media, and it was ugly. It's horrific. War is horrific. Mm-hmm. But what? And if you read the book Tennyson, came out a number of years ago now, decades ago, but they really make the, and they take the battle for
Tokyo.
No, the island. Island.
Oh,
island.
No.
Island.
Not Corregidor.
No. If I heard it, I would.
No.
Alcatraz, I think. Anyway, the point is, here's this island cut off from everything. Month will be in and out. You had 16-inch guns pounding, pummeling. I mean, it was a destroyed moonscape. You talk about after the Rodeo Chesky fire, boom, and they said, yep, we'll be in and out. We needed that island to make, and eventually I think they found out, you know what, we can go around some of these islands. We don't have to extricate the Japanese. Let them stay there. And they make for, no, it wasn't Midway. Not Guam. Not Iwo Jima. Not Iwo. See, I'll have to look at it. That's what happens when you... But here's the interesting thing. The battle for that island is what influenced our president and others to say, you know what, we are not going to invade Japan. We can't.
Yeah.
General MacArthur, who was uncanny, he was a tremendous strategist and very good at estimations. He estimated it would cost 5 million lives, 1 million Allied, 4 million Japanese, to invade and take...